Since Bobby Ann Mason has returned to Kentucky, have you had any contact with her?
Yes. We've been, Bobby Ann has a career that's different in shape from Wendell Gurney Edmonds. If she, although she was writing very creditable stories at the time she was an undergraduate, did not pursue her fiction writing instincts for another 20 years. She went to New York and was a professional writer for a fan club, a movie magazine, and then she went back to graduate school. She got a PhD. She wrote a book on Nabokov. She wrote a book on Nancy Drew. And then after years and years, she returned with some trepidation to her instincts as a fiction writer, and then became Bobby Ann Mason to everyone's amazement in a very quick, short period of time. And I knew Bobby Ann went to graduate school at the University of Connecticut when I was there. Mm-hmm. And we got a friendship. We had known one another and of one another until that time, but actually had an embodied friendship from that time on. And I was very close to the man she married, good friends with Roger, and have stayed in touch with Bobby Ann since those days. And then she has recently moved back to just outside Lawrenceburg and to Mary Ann and my delight. And we've seen them several times since they've gotten back and look forward to years of that.
Right. You mentioned your current wife. When did you meet and marry her?
We've known one another. We met when I was a visiting writing teacher at UK in 1966 or 7 for 1 year before I came back, or 68 I guess it was, 67, 68. She was teaching at UK at the time, and we met and had mutual friends and stayed in touch with one another over those years, but we didn't take up our friendship in this way until about 79 and 80.
What was she teaching at UK?
She was teaching, I think at the time, she was full-time freshman English teacher with a section of survey course in British Lit. Mm-hmm. She has taught creative writing on a part-time basis over the years since then, but at that time she was a regular English teacher. And we took up in 79 and got married, I think, in, I was living in New York in 79 and 80, and we got married in 81, I think.
You were on a sabbatical?
I had a sabbatical and then an NEA grant, and they were back-to-back, and so I was in New York for most of that time. And I was in Hawaii part of the time, but in New York City for most of that 2 years. And then when I came back from New York, we took up and got married shortly thereafter. So we've been married, we've been together for about 11 years.
No children from this marriage?
No children from this marriage.
And she is also a writer?
She's a fiction writer, and an extraordinarily good one. And a superb reader, and I have in-house help with my work, the likes of which you're not supposed to expect. All right.
And she must too.
No, I don't know. She can speak for herself, but yeah, I mean, I should hope.
Do you ever envision working together, or have you in the Louise Erdrich, Michael Doris?
No,
sense.
No. You mean collaborating as
yes,
as writer? No,
right.
No. We have given joint readings, and that's an interesting possibility. And I, she doesn't like to read publicly, but I kind of like to read with her. And I have imagined sharing a job with her in which she and I would alternate semesters. I don't know whether that will ever happen or not, but I'm looking for, I've got work that I'm doing as a photographer, I've got work I'm doing as a filmmaker, I've got work I'm doing as both a fiction writer and a poet. So I'm constantly looking for working time and for uninterrupted working time.
Right.
And I get it during the school year. The job I've got is very good in that the university conceives of my responsibilities as equally divided between teaching and doing my own work. So I teach only two workshops a semester. Yeah, right. And have time during the year to do my own work, but it is not the uninterrupted, uncomplicated time that you need, that I need for some tasks. And so I'm constantly looking for long stretches of time, months in a row, in which I can immerse myself in my work.
Do you do that in the summer?
I do that every summer, and I do it every chance that I get. I mean, the work that I'm doing right now, which is an autobiographical meditation that will either be in its final form presented as such, or the names will be changed and it will be a novel. I don't know yet which, but it's a protracted job of work that can't be done, couldn't be done without trance-like circumstances. All right?
Right,
it's an effort to remember my childhood without the aid of memory, and there's no way that I can do that and answer the telephone.
Right.
And that's been going on for 5 years now, you know, and I've been struggling the whole time to handle my responsibilities to my job and to this work.
Have you been doing other writing in between?
Yeah, I've in order to get to this book, in order to understand that this was the book I had to write, I've got a couple of novels that I'm a lot of the way through, and it was only after getting almost to the end of one of those novels and being unable to bring it off, being unable to clarify the subject, that I understood I had to write another book before I could finish that one, you know, before I had to relieve that novel of the torture of this unattended business in my own life.
So in the meantime, have you written a complete novel while working on this?
No, I have put that novel on the shelf and look forward with great delight in going back to it, because it's a job of work free of the private anguish of this meditation. And you know, I'm essentially I think as a fiction writer, a comic writer, and this novel that I'm talking about is essentially a comic novel, but I could never get free for the comedy in it, because it was bearing the burden of all this not understood anguish. So I look forward with great delight in going back to that work, but I got this one to finish first.
It sounds as though you have the same cooperative, supportive relationship, you and your wife, with your writing and her writing, as you had with your friends you were talking about, only more so than
more so. Yeah, yeah.
But you don't feel a competitive.
Oh no, there's not absolutely no competition between us, and She could not be more desirous of my well-being in all regards, and the well-being of my writing is tantamount to the clarity of my mind. So she wants, you know, she wants it as much as I do. And this is a lot more intimate and private and difficult than any friend could cope with. I mean, the kind of help that I need now. Though one of the jobs of work that this book, which is called Saying Grace, has to do is therapeutic. And the hand-holding and soul-searching that attends on the therapy of that work is not something that a friend can do, right? I mean, you drive a friend crazy in a short period of time by asking this kind of attention. But she's right there all the time for it.
Right. Are you, in terms of your working habits, how do you work that out with two of you? Are you in separate places during the days when you're both working? Or
yeah.
Are you usually working at the same time in the same house? What?
No, I have much more regular work habits than she does. And we have separate studies. In the new house that we're building, we'll even separate them further. The study that we have now is two adjacent rooms down the hill from the house. And she comes and goes as her psyche requires with her work. Mine requires that I keep a fairly regular schedule, and I write when I have my druthers and freedom in the matter. I get up very early.
How early is
that? Well, 5 or 5:30, and go straight to my study with a cup of coffee, and can work depending on what I'm working on and what stage it's in. Can work for 4 or 5 or 7 or 8 hours. And do, and am completely happy doing that, either in the study or in the studio, depending on what I'm working on, or in the film room. But one of the things that I had to prove to myself when I left graduate school and decided that I was going to act like a writer was that I had the discipline necessary to pursue such an ambition. And I didn't have it. My life was pretty chaotic, even as a graduate student. I did not have the discipline that a writer needs. So I made an inviolable pact with myself that I would put in a certain number of hours every day, even if it meant just sit there. And it took about 10 years of that before I was satisfied that I could get up and go if I wanted to. But I still am fairly formulaic about the discipline involved, and I like to sit there. My peace of mind hinges on sitting there, whether or not I'm able to do anything. So I work every day that I can for long hours, and she works almost every day, but not such long hours.
And is this also true with you during the school year? Are you able to write and teach on the same day?
No, I do. When I go into school, I try to do all my work, all of my teaching responsibilities in 2 days. Sometimes I have to go back a third day for departmental responsibilities and for conferences or whatnot. But I go in early and I stay late, and I don't try to do anything except that. And I do 12-hour days and throw myself into it. And then when I'm not going to school, I go to my study or to my studio.
I wanted to ask you about your 3 books of poetry and 2 completed novels. There are two.
There are two published novels.
Published,
yeah.
Yes. Not including the ones you were just talking about.
Right.
Can you tell me about your books of poetry and their genesis?
The first book, which is called Getting It On Up to the Brag, is a chapbook. I mean, a short book, 20 pages or so, published by the Larkspur Press, which is in Monterey, Kentucky, and the Larkspur Press is not a publisher. It's Gray Zeitz is an absolutely brilliant printer, an artist of very considerable achievement, and has published a number of titles, mostly Kentucky authors. And he had at in the mid 70s, when Larkspur did that title, an apprentice, Vicky White, who wanted to do a book of poems of mine, and we got together and did it. And they printed it on letterpress in the most exquisite and beautiful fashion. And the next book, called Her Name, was published by a small press in Wisconsin, Minnesota, called Pentagram. And Pentagram is a publisher, and I mean the difference is quite important, right? A printer is making a beautiful book, and what happens to it after he's
right.
printed it is of less concern than it would be to a publisher. The second book, I think, getting off to the brag, was published, as I remember, in 1975, and Her Name in, God, I ought to be able to remember this, but like 78 or 9, mm-hmm. and that was published and reviewed, but not widely. The Getting It On Up to the Brag, I think, had one review, and that was later on. It was an essay about me and my work that included Getting It On Up to the Brag. And then the third book was published by Wesleyan University Press in Connecticut in 1988. Is that right?
Sounds right.
Yeah. Stopping on the Edge
reading.
To Wave. And that title is the that's the best of the three books by a long shot, and includes most of my work in poetry that I think of as my mature work. And
what is it about that book that makes it the best, as far as you're concerned?
Well, I understood in the poems in that book much more clearly what I was writing about, and I was much more able to handle it. I had been writing poems for a number of years at that point, and had written some poems that seemed to me rereadable and okay. But it wasn't, and several. I mean, I don't want to. There are several poems in Getting It On Up to the Brag that I still read in public readings, and I still read with respect and delight. And there are a couple in Her Name, but there are a number of poems in Stopping on the Edge to Wave that I always turn to when I read publicly, and then I read with some, go back to with some simple feeling, and some. Abiding respect. And the poems in that book were in the main free of what I call my private biography, or the life that began when I was born.
Mm-hmm.
They're free of that part of my life, and hark back to the life that began a long time before I was born. Okay, my inheritance is
mm-hmm.
as a human being on the face of the earth, and
you've gone from a particular to a universal experience.
Well, I wouldn't. Yeah, I have. That would be one way of put it. I think I would say that in the period of time between Her Name and Stopping on the Edge to Wave, I had a very essential change in who I thought I was, and who the self was. All right, it was no longer simply, by any manner of means, that private person whose life started in 1935,
That's what I meant, right.
I think the first two books are true to myself as I understood who myself was at that time, okay?
Right.
But I was much more tied up and in a knot in those years than I was in the period beginning in the early 80s.
Right.
And I've had more success with my poetry in periodical publication than I have in book publication. I mean, Stopping on the Edge to Wave, for instance, been out a couple of years now, and maybe I've seen a review or two. I'm not looking for them, but that book has, although it was published by one of the best poetry publishers in the country and should, on the basis of the imprint, have gotten, and where the poems appeared in periodicals, should have gotten reviewed in a number of places. I don't know whether it has or not. I doubt that it has. The periodical publication in poetry for me broke, and I started getting in all of the places that I wanted to get in the early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the poems, most of them, that are in Stopping on the Edge to Wave.
And those periodicals are New Yorker?
New Yorker, Poetry Magazine, American Poetry Review, Kenyon mm-hmm. Review, Hudson Review, Swanee Review,
all the top
Poetry
ones.
Northwest.
Essentially the top ones.
Yeah, the places that you want to publish as a,
right.
As a poet. And I got in when I started writing poetry to one or two of those places, and then, you know, as the years went on, three or four, but I finally broke the New Yorker, which is the hardest of all of those places to get into, somewhere in the early 80s, and that seemed to me to be a kind of fruition
right.
of my public the public part of my poetry writing.
And had you been submitting to the New Yorker regularly?
Every writer I know submits to the New Yorker periodically. I don't know anybody who. I went through a period of 10 years in which I didn't, because it just was out of my mind. I wasn't thinking about it. And I don't know when I started again. But at some point I said, okay, I'm going to try the New Yorker again. And I did, and I don't know how long it took for them to take a poem, but Bobby Ann's story in that regard I remember more clearly than my own. She went through 22 submissions to the New Yorker, in which she was treated with great respect every time, and got long letters from Roger Angel, the fiction editor, about this story, which they rejected, and they rejected, and they rejected, but they kept saying, you know, we want to accept something. 22 of these. And then finally she was accepted, and then she was in no time at all a New Yorker writer, and that's mm-hmm. where her reputation was made.
Right.
I don't remember how many times I tried the New Yorker with poems. I didn't write any poems for, you know, a bunch of years in there.
Okay. But Ann Beattie was the same way.
Ann Beattie was the same way. I don't know how long it took her to break, but once she broke the New Yorker, they've got the power. The only magazine in the country with anything like this power to make a career just by mm-hmm. deciding to. And if they decide
right.
that they're going to take you on, then book publishers start coming after you,
mm-hmm.
and you're somebody in the career end of fiction or poetry writing, and you got it made.
Just as an aside about the New Yorker, how would you assess the general quality of the stories, the fiction and the poetry in the magazine now?
Well, I think the New Yorker is the most extraordinary literary magazine perhaps it's ever been produced in several regards. It's the most impeccably produced magazine that you'll ever find. There's hardly ever a typo in it, and it comes out once a week, and it's the professionalism with which that magazine is produced is quite astonishing. The poetry editor, when I had poems in the New Yorker was Howard Moss, and his judgment in poetry is fairly widely respected. They're always going to be, they publish two or three poems a week, they're always going to be, to anybody's judgment, poems that you can't understand what Howard Moss saw in, all right, why they're there. But the general level of the poetry within his range of interest, it seemed to me, was fairly high. The fiction has been edited by four or five people over the last 20 years, and they haven't always been of the same mind. But when you consider the fact that Salinger, Updike, Cheever, Roth, and after a while Saul Bellow and Stein and all of and W.S. Merwin, and Beattie and Bobby and Mason and on and on and on, that a lot of writers whose work I admire deeply, Salinger, my God, and W.S. Merwin, they're regular New Yorker writers. All of that considered, it seems to me rather picky to say, I don't like a lot of stories in New Yorker, which I don't.
Yeah.
You know?
I just wondered if you thought that there was, maybe in the last decade, I guess it wouldn't be fair to say since the editorial turnover there, since Newhouse took over the magazine, the fiction has seemed to be shorter and of a much more experimental, non-traditional short story nature in terms of their often being a beginning or a middle and not necessarily a beginning, middle, and end.
Yeah, right. I think Gottlieb's New Yorker is quite different than the one that preceded. Right. I don't think there's any question about that. And maybe the literary judgment effective there now is not so much to my liking as it was before. I don't read it regularly enough to come down too hard on that. But
then it may be a change in fiction writing in general.
It may
the
very
nature
well
of it
be.
In the country as opposed to magazine.
Yeah, I mean, books have gotten shorter, one would assume, because people's attention span have gotten shorter.
Certainly the state of mind in journalism for magazine articles. New Yorker is one of the few publications that, in terms of their nonfiction, has refused to compromise.
Oh, their nonfiction is a case in point, professional beyond the measure of any other magazine, and it's always good writing, and it's always deeply researched and a very thorough, thoughtful, intelligent explication of the most unlikely things in some cases. But, I mean, say they've published, I mean, you look at the format of the New Yorker and contend with the advertising in it, and then deal with the fact that John McPhee publishes there all the time. Some of the best nature writers, some of the best naturalistic writers in the world are publishing there. Put all that together. It's quite extraordinary what they do there.
Right.
And that they do it week in and week out, 52 times a year.
Right. Back to your poetry, reading your poetry, so many of your poems describe nature or cultivate nature as metaphor. What is your view of the relationship between nature and human nature? And is nature for you an objective correlative or something else?
Well, I think the distinction between nature and human nature is a tricky, potentially disastrous distinction. It seems to me that a good deal of the trouble that we're in the world is a function of the fact that we think that human beings are outside or apart from nature. The natural world, which I'm living in the middle of all the time, is the life of all of the creatures on the face of the earth that aren't human, that whose well-being I feel deeply connected with, and the longer I spend out in the grass and among the creatures, the more deeply my connection and identification with them becomes. It is very much within its own terms in that regard. It's not a metaphor for anything. I mean, it's the cat, this cat, and that dog, and that cow, and that blade of grass. The experience of that cat, that dog, and that blade of grass in my mind is the experience of ongoing transience that's very vivid and very inescapable. They live and die very quickly, you know. I mean, bugs come and go, particular bugs come and go so rapidly, and their tenure here is so thusly vivid, that the overriding experience of my own life, which is of transience, of being in unstable state at all times. I mean, nothing, no moment is trappable. It's followed by the next moment, the next moment, the next moment. The essential experience is one of everything being taken away at the same time that it's given. And the life of human beings and of rocks and of certain parts of nature is much more difficult to see that dramatically played out than it is with the grass and with the bugs.
But that connection does make a cow more than a cow and grass more than grass, because you're making the connection, doesn't it?
Yeah. But you get, but I always get back to the fact that it's just the cow and just the grass.
Well, both.
It's indeed both. But it's another form of life that appeared and disappeared at the same moment, in which its appearance and disappearance are breathtakingly simultaneous.
I'm not suggesting that you're reading something into the objects you're describing, but from them, relating something about their experience or about
themselves to your own life. Yeah, it's a mirror.
Right.
Sure. I mean, in that regard, indeed, there's something more than each particular item. It's a mirror in which I'm seeing what I understand to be the essential nature of things.
Right.
Which is passing, death.
Your earlier books of poetry seem to have many more nature poems, or they use nature as a subject more than in your later collections.
Isn't it the reverse? The Stopping on the Edge to Wave, the last book's much more oriented to the natural world than the first two books.
I'm thinking of your first.
The first.
Yeah, maybe it's particular poems I'm thinking of.
There are a couple of what we're calling nature poems and getting it on up to the brag, but a lot of the poems in that book are like zany portraits of people and of situations, they're not natural. Almost all the poems in Stopping on the Edge to Wave are set in the landscape of the natural world.
Right. Okay. In your poem Tracings, you describe how photography captures the human spirit. What do you think are the similarities and differences between capturing that spirit in photography and in writing?
Photography has a very specific and curious and quite dramatic relationship with this whole subject of time and the passage of time. A still photograph is punching a hole in time. It is freezing a moment and taking up one of these evanescent transient experience and making it stand still for a certain period of time. And the spiritual drama of a still photograph for me is in the context of its extraordinary act in the flow of time. Mm-hmm. Fiction and for me is poetry and photography are much more on a vertical axis for me, dealing in lyric poetry and in photography. I can address myself more directly to the absolute than I can in fiction. Fiction is a social activity. It's about characters in time and place, and the characters are the substance of a lot of the story, and the situation, their setting is right at the heart of the story. Those things are located in time, and if a story involves a long period of time, then the passage of time is right at the heart of the story. But the ability, the call of the lyric poem and of the photograph to speak directly to what some people would call God or the absolute or to eternity, to timelessness, is much more direct. It's called upon, it's on that axis between the earth and the heavens, and the fiction is on like a horizontal axis wrapped around the earth. My preoccupation, and it seems, although I don't think in these terms or work in these terms, but the preoccupation of my vision seems to be with transience, with time. I mean, it's a time preoccupied vision. And the experience of arriving at the experience of timelessness, of the trance, of the meditative consciousness, is the experience that the nature poems are constantly trying to achieve. It's trying to achieve the meditative concentration on the subject that punches one through time into a kind of timelessness. And with photography, it's the same instinct. It's trying to find the image that will invite the connection between time and timelessness.
Do you feel equally adept at all media, all genres, or is it simply a matter of whatever your vision is trying to relate, as you're talking about one being more suitable for a particular?
Well, that's a really good question, because my public career as an artist has been enormously complicated and some would say destroyed by my devotion to several different media. And you don't make film or photographs or poems or stories without a long apprenticeship. And it's unlikely that anybody is going to serve the necessary apprenticeship in more than one of those areas in order to achieve full potential, all right? And here what I'm trying to do is to work in four different mediums. I feel at this point as though I have in the past several years arrived at my maturity as an artist and am able to do now the work I've been preparing myself to do, that I've been trying to get through to all these years, and it seems to me now that my work in photography, which gave way at a certain point because of frustrations that I was feeling with still photographs into filmmaking, and my work in lyric poetry and my work in fiction have all been efforts to get the resources to punch through the same hole, all right? It took the film in order to make me see in still photography what I needed to see in order to understand what it was that I knew. Mm-hmm. What I knew but didn't know that I know. And each one of those endeavors has been in the service of the same effort to give me the resources to articulate what it is that I know. I think now, although I'm not the one to comment on this, that I have more or less equal competence in those different areas. I haven't done nearly as much work in film as I have in photography. I had no right to say that yet in film. But I feel as though the apprenticeship that I have served in each of these areas has been responsible in its own terms, and that I understand what serious poets have gone through in the way of training and serious fiction writers have gone through in the way of training. And that the book that I'm writing now, Saying Grace, I could not have gotten through to, it's prose, but I could not have found the language for it had I not done the work I had done in lyric poetry.
So you're really saying that working in the different media cross-pollinate.
Absolutely, and they've all been tracking the same subject.
Mm-hmm.
The writing of Saying Grace, this autobiographical meditation, has been accompanied by a parallel project in which I am re-photographing the Hall family albums.
Mm.
And that has been another way in which I have gotten into the cave that it was sealed off from me. I could not have verified my intuitions that language brought me to without the aid of those photographic images that came straight off of the Hall family albums. It was a not only a cross-pollination, but a whole process of mutual confirmation that went on in those parallel projects. I am dealing with the lives of other people and making, not just myself, but my mother and my father and my grandparents and so forth and so on, in which the things that I thought I had to say had to be verified somewhere in my experience.
Right.
And it took my work in photography, which was informed and brought to the place that it was by filmmaking, in order to verify the language that I came to, that I got, prose language that I came to, that I got to through the language of lyric poetry. You understand what I'm saying? I mean, all of these things have been tools to track the same experience,
right,
to come into the presence of the images at the bottom of the cave of my mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like back when my mother killed herself, the entrance to that cave was sealed off.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to find some way back in there, and then I had to be able to read the paintings that had been left on the wall. All right? And all of the training that I had looking at Gauguin and Van Gogh and Rothko and Matisse were part of the training of my eye that I was able to then elaborate on in my still photography, that such that when I got into the cave and I had the light to shine on the wall, I knew how to get the image back outside. But this has nothing to do with a career as an artist. Like, in as far as being on the public scene as an artist, what I have done through all of that, all of those endeavors, to shoot myself in the foot over and over and over again. You know, I mean, here's Hall. Who does he think he is? Is he a filmmaker? Is he a photographer? Is he a poet? Or is he a fiction writer? That's an invitation to be treated like a dilettante in the professional world of art careers.
True, but same in the academic world if you're
right.
doing a variety of things.
You ain't got a chance.
It's truly someone else's problem, and you can pay your dues in a variety of ways, but most people...
Oh, right. I don't think it is any longer a problem with me.
Right.
But for a long time it was a problem, and if I ever went back in the, out in the world and on the street to make my to make a career, it would be a problem to me again. You know,
right.
I mean, people would say, "Oh, what are you?"
Right.
And I don't care anymore. But you know, I'm not on the street, and I'm not promoting my career as an artist.
Right.
I'm not looking. I'm not doing that. If I was doing that, it'd be a problem to me because it's a problem for other people.
But you have had acceptance in all the media.
Yeah, and enough.
So you don't have to prove any of it.
Not any longer.
Right.